girl. You see, man made the cars to take us over the road. Man made the train to carry the heavy load. Man made the electrolyte to take us out of the dark. Man made the boat for the water, like Noah made the ark. This is a man's, man's, man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing, without a woman or a girl. And a baby boys. Man make them happy, 'cause man make them toys. And after man make everything, everything he can, you know that man makes money to buy from other men. This is a man. Without a woman or a girl. He's lost in the wilderness. He's lost in bitterness.
And I have to say that there's something about James Brown that just puts me in the mood to talk a little bit. It's a man's, man's, man's world. Is it really, you know, maybe gender isn't the issue anymore, but this is always an interesting roundtable. And I'm Randy Moggins. This is the Liberty Beacon Media Network, and this is the Man Talk Show. I'll bring my guests up in a minute. You know, how flipping cool is this? In a single evening's programming tonight, we had Leslie Carroll Both, a wonderful show, Women's Health Show. She is a world-renowned expert on hormones, female reproductive issues, vaccines, health issues, the onslaught of just about everything that you can throw at human biology. And we followed that up at the following hour with Dylan Wade and two of his friends. Dylan Wade is 15 years old. And as we round the clock on this hour, you're going to get to hear two of my colleagues in the world of talk shows, people that are making a difference in very different but very interesting ways. And that's what this network is about. This network is about people who want to make a difference, who are going to throw their voice out there and be heard and affect a change. And I can't think of two people I'd rather be on with as we launch this network than from to my right, facing north, way down under in New Zealand. He is probably one of the best known personalities, a videographer and activist, a man who goes out into the streets and deals with the people and deals with real issues. Mr. Vincent Eastwood is here. Vinny, good evening.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And to my north, facing north, straight on, he is, well, he is above all else, I guess we would say, the sensei.
We have a clip, don't we, Randy?
Here in this dojo!
Joe, we don't even know what a dojo is.
There's no mercy in this dojo!
Joe, why don't you take it down a notch?
No mercy!
Yes, it is. This is David Whitehead from Canada. Good evening and welcome.
Hey guys, hello everybody. That's awesome. Way to intro there, Randy. That's a great clip. And there is no mercy in my dojo. Well, maybe a little bit of mercy, but not for me anyways. And I'm very happy to have been able to make this time slot. And Randy, thanks for hosting this on your show. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this is the first week of this media project that we formed with the people at the Liberty Beacon. And it's been an interesting experiment along the way. It's new media raw. We're just kind of we're winging it out there right now. And as we go into the night show, I know we're going to cover a lot of ground. Vinny, right now I would have to say that you may be one of the most controversial figures in terms of what's been going on with you, given your coverage of the elections in New Zealand and the subsequent takedown of your YouTube channel. Give us an update on that.
Well, there really is not a whole lot to update, but the I made a six-minute video about the Prime Minister John Key's past, his banking connections, what he plans to do with the country, as he's admitted, his association with basically the worst banking criminal scum in history were his mentors. Let me put it like that. And it's unequivocal. And in 6 minutes, you realize who this guy is. And it was so effective, and it was starting to go viral, that after the sixth day, rather biblically, my YouTube channel was put to rest permanently without warning because of that video alone. And there were thousands of videos on that YouTube channel, 3.5 million hits, 16,000 subscribers. I was the most subscribed YouTube channel to put out news in New Zealand, even larger than the mainstream media's YouTube channel variants, the largest one at the time being New Zealand Herald, who hadn't even gotten past the 10,000 subscriber mark, and they've been around for 150 years, that media entity has, as well as being the country's number one website, and I beat them on YouTube by myself. Of course, with the help of guests to fill out content and my donors and subscribers who just basically pay my day-to-day living expenses so that I can keep serving humanity instead of, well, I can't get a job because I'm employer phobic. It's a mental illness that I made up, just like all other mental illnesses, of course, where I have a fear of gainful employment. Basically a non-submission to authority. And it's actually a very real thing. Even my best friend Jono, who actually just incidentally came round here about an hour ago, offered me a job selling insulation, and I went in and I did the interview and it was all fine. I mean, but the night before going into work, I actually had a panic attack just lying there in bed, you know, like hyperventilating and everything, really freaked my wife out. And I think that was the day that I realized that there is no going back. You know, I cannot go back and do a normal job. I can't live an ordinary life anymore. I am here merely as a servant for those in my nation and, of course, countries around the world who expose scumbaggery by hook or by crook and ensure the survival of the human race, or at least they play their part. And there's an old saying, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And that something that I can do is channel information and allow people to listen from the horse's mouth directly to what's going on both in New Zealand and around the world. Now, in order for my YouTube channel to be deleted, that's basically the work of my 20s. This is actually the longest I've ever been in any kind of job. And, of course, it's a self-perpetuating mystery to me why I haven't died yet. But the YouTube channel getting deleted was such a big kind of emotional blow to me. And I thought I was handling it rather well. But a couple of weeks passed and it actually started to take its toll on me, because not only had I lost the work of my 20s, and I'm just about to turn 30 at the end of this year, so, you know, watch out. And It kind of, I would say, I actually didn't really feel that bad about it initially. What I felt initially wasn't loss, it was freedom. I felt as though I had always been editing videos and putting them up on a constant basis and answering comments and that kind of thing and heavily involved in it. When it got deleted, I no longer had any of those responsibilities because I couldn't fulfill them. And what it allowed me to do was to retool, more or less. And so other than that, I did try to email YouTube and ask others to email them on my behalf, all of which received automatic replies saying this email for this particular YouTube channel has been banned, and if you want it to be unbanned, then you need to sign into your banned YouTube channel with your banned email and then send us an email that's banned from your banned YouTube channel to us in order to get us to reply. It's like the ultimate catch 22. You just can't make this stuff up. You just can't win if you try. And so I've been asking other radio show hosts and YouTubers to upload their own videos and their own and make mentions of it on broadcast in order to bring public awareness to this, because I am aware that a number of people like Mark Dice, for instance, and of course Alex Jones have had their YouTube channels deleted in the past. And probably under similar circumstances, and they've managed to get their channels put back up. Now, unfortunately, because I can't contact YouTube because they won't let me or anyone else, it means that it has to be the court of a public opinion that actually reaches YouTube, and I cannot do that by myself, especially without a YouTube channel. That said, I had two YouTube channels, one that I hadn't touched in 5 years, which I had primarily used for my initial cannabis activism and also to make dance party videos for people. Like back when I was first starting, they paid me like $50 to like film the whole night and edit a video. It wasn't much, but it was enough to keep me fed. And so what I've done is I've got my second slave computer next to my main that is constantly uploading now, hundreds of videos at a time. I had five full hard drives that are like, well, no, ranging between 4 and 2 terabyte hard drives that took about a month to get all the videos of those on. And then I thought to myself, there has to be a few more hard drives. So I look in my closet, and sure enough, I found another 6 hard drives, and so now they're uploading, and goodness knows how long that's going to take. So you're talking about probably one of the largest bodies of work comparable to anybody else's program catalog on YouTube, more or less. Thousands upon thousands of videos, many of them well over an hour in length, with celebrities like Tila Tequila and top researchers, David Icke and what's his name, Foster Gamble from the Thrive Movement, and John Perkins, and all of these kind of things were up there, and they no longer are. So, yeah, I just need people's help and support to appeal to YouTube to reinstate that old channel, because it was quite depressing looking through all these uploads, and where previously I would see 20,000 views or 10,000 views or something on selected videos, I now see 1 view, no views, 16 views, that kind of thing, and it's actually quite depressing.
Well, you know, it brings to the forefront the question, we're almost now at the mercy of a few small companies on the internet as content providers. YouTube, with the flick of a switch at the behest of their cabal masters, can take down an entire channel, wipe out an entire website. And this is the threat that we now face to, we're now facing with new media. I don't know if you guys saw this or not. I posted this on Facebook yesterday. Gordon Duff of Veterans Today put up an article called Monsters Among Us. You see this article?
Yeah, I looked it over, Randy, and he definitely covers some very critical information for people to learn when it comes to social media and the way that it's been going, and you know, the whole design of how it just... You know, it's a filter for information. It's a surveillance tool. It's all these things. And thank goodness we do have people that are doing shows like what we're doing and the work that Vinny's been doing. And anybody that's listening to this show, you know, the information that Randy's going to, I'm sure, go through regarding this article will really help sink into you why it's important to support grassroots, local radio shows, activists, community groups, community gardening groups, anything that is trying to stand outside of the parameters of this system of control that is growing rapidly. We need to support that. And so that's what I'm here to do. That's what we're all here to do. And anybody listening, I just urge you to keep researching this, keep getting more awareness spread on these issues, because I think this is a time of an incredible conflict that's actually really going on. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Randy.
Well, let me read a little bit of this article, and you can find this over at Veterans Today. I can probably post the link over to the chat as well. But Gordon Duff at Veterans Today, and people should know that Gordon Duff is one of the he is probably singularly one of the largest private intelligence operatives in the world. He is deeply connected inside of the government, the military, and he has been running a whistleblower outfit. I don't necessarily agree with everything that Veterans Today puts out or everybody that's there, but I have to say that overall, I consider them right now to be a major organ, along with RT and a couple other networks out there that appear to be putting out pretty much the undiluted truth. This takes some cojones. Gordon Duff writing in the article "Monsters Among Us." Today, I want to cite two security threats above all.
Before you do, Veterans Today just got hacked. I just got off the phone with two contributors to Veterans Today, Dr. Kevin Barrett and Professor Jim Fetzer, and it was hacked directly after that article came up.
Yeah, because I can't even open that article now. I'm trying.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Yeah.
So for the record here, we'll put it on sound. Gordon Duff says, today I want to cite two security threats above all, Google and Wikipedia. And we all know about the wiki and what goes on with the editing and deletions over there. It would be oversimplistic to call them CIA or Mossad fronts. They are quite worse than that. Whoever owns or manages these organizations, they were created at the outset by groups within the U.S. military intelligence at the Presidio, groups long tied to the systematic control of all world media. It is not a secret that Google, Facebook, Microsoft, I'm sorry to say it, Apple, have all been in some way co-opted, if not directly funded, by these the Zionist media operatives.
Well, so, can I also add something there? The CIA got involved in the early 90s in what they call venture capital funds. There are actually CIA-backed venture capital funds because they came to the realization that they couldn't be at the head of the development of surveillance technology and new inventions and things of that nature. They simply didn't have the money or the expertise to recruit all of the world's top thinkers and get them to create things specifically for them. So they created these venture capital companies, which would go to technology conferences and things of that nature, and they would select those people who had most promising technological developments to fund, and as a result gain control of the aforementioned technology. And one of these CIA companies gave venture capital to Mark Zuckerberg, creator of Facebook, and there's actually quite a long list. I'm not able to really rant it off, but there you go.
Well, what I discovered was that I don't know how many people now remember the antitrust suit that was brought against Microsoft. And I mean, look, Bill Gates comes from a cabal bloodline family. The Gates family goes back to the early 20th century connections with the Rockefellers. What a surprise. But the antitrust suit that was settled by Microsoft with the U.S. Department of Justice, what many people don't realize, and I was told this by people who were working in IT at the time, and this was probably in the late 90s, that one of the backroom results of that that settlement was that Microsoft basically allowed a backdoor to be installed into all of their Windows operating systems, not just commercial consumer Windows, but also all of the server networks that were then being deployed to serve, wait for it, the banking industry. And so every major technology company in some way has likely been compromised in some way, either through subversion, through funding, as Vinny was discussing, or in having their software compromised somewhere down the line by NSA hacking. Because what we know now is that the NSA itself is actually the originator of many of the viruses, bots, and spamming that's bringing down websites globally. It's all part of their cyber warfare units.
Now, there's an analogy which Ian Wishart, really good New Zealand journalist, put in his new book, Totalitaria. If you can find that, go read it. It's pretty spectacular. But it's the Kevin Bacon connection, all right? So in Hollywood, there was an article a while back saying that everybody in Hollywood, through one degree or another, whether that be one degree of separation all the way through to seven, is connected in some way to Kevin Bacon. For example, for example, somebody who was in a film with Kevin Bacon has a detachment of one, whereas somebody who knows somebody who was in a film that was related to somebody else who was in a film with Kevin Bacon has a relationship of two. And this is actually how the global intel community kind of works, is that basically they're all connected in some way with the Bacon connection. You know what I'm saying? You know, that's why they tell so many porkies.
Well, and here in Canada, we know for a fact that our government here, the Harper administration, I mean, this came out even in mainstream news here in Canada, where we know that they're hiring intelligence agents or government agents to go onto social media websites, and their claim is that they're there to correct misinformation or to debunk disinformation. That's their job. So they actually admitted to creating false avatars or pseudonyms to go online and interact on the blogs, on the YouTube channels, on Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff, and to actually try to disseminate information that would apparently to them stop the spread of misinformation. And we all know what that means. These guys are in bed with the intelligence agencies. You know, here in Canada, it's CSIS, which is just another branch of the same intelligence spider web that, you know, essentially has control in around the world. And we basically have the same surveillance program, and these governments are working in tandem with them. Some people even look at it as the fact that they're working for them. And being that our country is so far deep in the debt hole, we know that our government really isn't making much in terms of decisions. They're just following orders, and they're being assigned to these kinds of projects. Even, you know, hardworking, you know, well-intentioned government workers, but at the same time, they are there spying and contributing to this paranoid surveillance state. So even here in Canada, we feel the same thing going on, where accounts are being hacked. My YouTube channel's had all kinds of issues. It's not been taken down, thank God, just yet. But we all know that this is going on. And I think that the more pressure we put on in the alternative media spectrum, the more the regular everyday person is going to get access to this information. Everybody I talk to now is starting to get wise to this, and they're already complaining about it and talking about it in public circles. So it means that we're doing our job, guys, and it's going well, even though we're getting opposition. And so I just say, stay in the fight, and we got to keep, you know, pushing it and putting out the information that we feel people should be able to hear.
Now, what you said there about them deliberately engaging in disinformation with the express goal of trying to prevent disinformation or to explain it, it actually falls under my two principal life assumptions. Number one, if it comes from an official source, whatever they're telling you that they're doing, they're probably doing the exact opposite. And number two, if you can't make it in your own kitchen with ingredients you can find, then it's a soft kill bioweapon.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, it's just, we all know this. We knew this when we started. I mean, the NSA, the CIA, I mean, they're the big guys. They've got the turf pretty much under wraps, you know, Mossad, all the big companies. But you also have smaller countries, and you have the governments working in tandem with the same characters, you know, whether it's through one organization or a certain bank or an intelligence agency that has connections over with intelligence agencies in America. However you look at it, when you follow the money and when you follow the tracks, you will really, honestly, this is not theory, guys. This is something that people can go and look up, and it's becoming put in our faces. It's almost, and I was going to ask you guys this, it almost to me seems like they don't mind if we know now. They don't really mind if we know that there is this new, you know, control systems coming in, more surveillance systems coming in, more advanced technology to merge us with and also have means of surveilling and building more of a controlled society. It's out there. They're talking openly and proudly about it. And it's as if they don't mind that we are aware that they're keeping tabs on us. You know what I mean?
Never underestimate the human capacity for hubris and just how dangerous it is to their very own agendas. And the way you're explaining it, it seems like more or less they use the exact same play cards, the exact same agencies in different countries, except they just do it in a different accent. Like the NSA in America is the NSA, but the NSA in Mexico is the NSA. And the NSA in Canada is just, it's the NSA.
Or we add an extra A. It's the NSA, eh?
Well, isn't this really the point, too, of what Snowden's been leaking out? I mean, I know there's a lot of noise out there that says that Snowden is either disinfo or COINTELPRO, and I'd welcome your comments on that as well. But we have been leaked a lot of information this at this point that indicates the depth of what the NSA has been involved with. And this came right as we became aware of this gigantic electronic data mining bunker that they've now erected out in Utah, which is just countless petabytes of data being accumulated, basically aggregating telecommunications, telephone calls, camera surveillance, GPS, satellite coordinates. The whole thing is being dumped into a gigantic data mining center where theoretically they now have the algorithms to be able to abstract this data in real time. I mean, Orwell was just, he was a little late to the game. I mean, 1984, we weren't quite there, but by 2014, it appears as though Big Brother has got his shit together.
Well, in reality, George Orwell wrote 1984 in 1948, and he simply reversed the numbers. And it was not a date, it was merely an elaboration upon the agendas in which public relations and scumbaggery would be used in order to control people without them realizing that they're being controlled, and in fact actually support, love, and devote themselves and be willing to die for the very thing that kills and enslaves them.
And it really is prophetic when you think about it. Or was it prophetic? Because Eric Arthur Blair was actually a British intelligence agent himself. So I suspect that he knew the game a long time ago. We know that these guys are running decades ahead of the common consensus. So I guess in a way it wasn't so much prophetic as just simply a question of how it was going to come together and the timing of the whole thing.
Now, he was clearly an insider and was, I mean, he was obviously trained by Aldous Huxley and some of these other Fabians. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's debate as to whether or not Orwell or Blair was sympathetic to the public in a way and knew what was coming down the pipeline, but wanted to reveal it in sort of a discreet way. And there's other people that think, no, it's just all encoded and this is how they do it. They just release a certain amount of information that locks in the mindset and it locks in the agenda when it's out in the public. So they've done their job. They've let us know. And then they just carry forward with it. And we're the ones that keep looking at it and go, oh, it's not really happening, but yet obviously it is happening. And there's so many things in that book. And if you look at Brave New World and all these various writings that have, and look at the movies. I mean, the movies, there's been so many things coming out from movies back in the 60s, 70s, 80s that were predicting the times that we're in now. And look at the movies that are coming out now. And it's all about alien invasions and world government and disorder and apocalypse and zombie apocalypses. And it's just, even in the kids' movies, they're telling you the direction. It's a pre-programming kind of ideology. And I think that that was just something that was obviously going on back then, as it is going on today, just in maybe a different way, different format.
Yeah, it's subliminally installed. I mean, even the all-seeing eye on the back of the American dollar is an embed that's very creepy and very ominous, and points towards this whole idea that we were moving towards the society where the government god would become omniscient and omnipresent.
Now, this is I want to actually switch us from this, because in this world of intelligence agencies that basically control things and surveil everybody and what have you, what relevance does politics and in particular voting have anymore? And my opinion is not that much. If you
right. This was a subject I wanted to get into you with, because, you know, during the New Zealand election, I occasionally kind of yanked your chain a little bit about the whole voting thing. And this is an intriguing subject, so let's do this.
See, I look at voting kind of like throwing a pebble into a lake. It ain't really going to change the lake, but frick, it's fun. You know, the lake's not going to recoil and go, oh, hey, this down at me. You know, that's basically how much power it is.
And maybe I'm too much of a purist on this. I gave up voting after 2000 elections when George Bush was swept into office here. And I saw the deceptions that went on in voting. But even more than that, for me at that point in time, it was where I was going in my research and what I discovered about the act of registering the vote and the fact that, now this is an American thing, but I suspect that in all of the empire nations that are tied to the cabal, there's some similar thing going on. Here in the United States, you register to vote. You've basically, first off, registering anything is a way to do something which would otherwise be prohibited. So the government has now given us permission to vote. They've given us a two-party system in most states with which to vote. Both sides rigged, both sides controlled. The 2000 election in the United States was a very good indicator of how far they would go to make sure that their guy got in. And I don't, you know, it's been said that here in the United States, we haven't had a president legally elected since Reagan in 1980. But the act of registering the vote, the fact that your citizenship as a living person on the land is not sufficient for you to cast a vote for your government, but that you have to go through documentation, certification, identification, and finally prostration to the government in order to be able to cast a vote, to me was so disturbing that I have never registered since. I don't plan to. Thus, I'm disenfranchised because I can't vote because of the mechanisms in the system.
If I was in America, I would have the exact same opinion to you, Randy, and I would refuse to vote. In New Zealand, it's slightly different, but I'll explain
and
that
I
in a minute.
I wondered about that. Yeah, let's talk.
Well, actually, David was about to say something, and I interrupted. Yeah. I'm sorry, bro.
Oh, no worries. And yeah, definitely get back to that, Vinny. I just wanted to mention that it does run. I mean, we have a two-party system here in Canada, and so it's the same kind of idea. And we know that there's a lot of these guys are, you know, they're Bilderberg attendees, you know, confirmed, and they are in bed with the same banking institutions, multinational corporations, lobby groups, the whole nine yards. It's essentially set up the same way. It's got slight differences, but I mean, we are a Commonwealth Crown corporately owned, you know, corporation, just like the rest of the countries in the world. And so we do have that system. And what I found out was interesting here in Canada was that you can register to have a no vote, basically meaning you can almost register to say, I choose neither of or any of these groups because I am so fed up with the way this is. Register to not vote. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. Imagine they got a big poll, although I'm sure they would never be honest about it. But imagine we got a poll of people that were so fed up with having the same line of bullshit come from either party. For years and years, no matter who gets in, Canada keeps getting dismantled. And now it's to the point with all these trade agreements that even the former defense minister of Canada, Paul Hellyer, who is 94 years old, is actually calling out the Canadian government on high treason. Mm-hmm. And it's these kinds of things that make me interested in politics, but at the same time, to see politicians that will speak out about it. But you're not going to have someone like, you know, Paul Heller. He's retired. He's just commenting. He can't, you're not going to vote for somebody like that. So I would say maybe register not to vote. That way, at least you're telling them, hey, we're fed up with the whole bloody thing.
What happened to the concept of a vote of no confidence where sufficient disinterest is expressed and the government is disbanded? This would be, to me, one of the fundamentals that I would interject in any new constitutional initiatives were we to get to the place where we could resume control of our government here in the United States, would be simply the idea that voting in the United States, the raw numbers are basically less than 30% of the people vote. So effectively, any leader is probably voted in by less than about 20% of the population if you assume full participation of the remaining percentage of that. There is no benchmark anymore because a majority is simply a majority of the number of registered voters that vote, rather than the idea that simply without guns, without revolution, we would say no confidence in the government, disband the government, convene a party, a group of electors, and let us begin again. But that's what political parties do. They basically control at all times both sides of the opposition to maintain control, which they jointly own in the governments.
And this is what really effed me off during the New Zealand election, is I would say one thing and then people would accuse me of believing something that's based on that. You know, like, for example, I'll say that I'm voting and then people would accuse me of thinking that voting mattered. You know, I mean, sure, that might be a logical conclusion, but at the end of the day, if you want to know my beliefs, why don't you just frickin' ask what they are, you know, rather than just assuming and labeling, rather, you know what I'm saying? And this is how the voting system works in New Zealand. Number one, you have to be registered to vote, and you have a $200 fine if you don't vote. However, there's plenty of people I know personally who have not registered and have not received a fine. So that seems like a bit of a farce to me. The other part is your proxy voting. If you are registered to vote and you don't vote, then your vote is given by proxy in the exact same percentage of how everybody yes. else would vote. All right. So
yes, exactly.
It's the exact same thing. If you're registered, you vote whether or not you want to. And it's not like that's written in the legislation. It's called mathematics. If 50% of people have the power to vote and 50% of people and 25% of those don't vote, that means the 25 remaining percent actually double the power of their vote. All right? One person votes for one party. That party basically, through a percentage-wise in terms of the percentage of votes, gets double the votes that they normally would if all of the other people actually participated. So the government in New Zealand has actually engaged in a deliberate agenda, and this has been exposed by a journalist called Nicky Hager, who wrote a book called Dirty Politics, where he revealed leaked emails between the Justice Minister and the one of the lead right-wing bloggers in New Zealand and caught them in a deliberate agenda to sling mud and cause and stir up crap among the voting public's mindset, more or less, to literally put them off voting. And the reason they did this is because they know, and this is absolutely self-evident in my opinion, they know that the morons who would vote for their party will be the last people to realize that there's something going on and refuse to vote. Okay? And that's why most people who vote tend to vote in a very, very stupid format, as if they had no idea who they were voting for or why. And so naturally, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who's gotten us into, I think, more debt in his first term alone than all previous prime ministers in New Zealand history combined by a huge margin, as in we've gone from 8 billion, that's the last 150 years of our country's existence, that's how much debt we racked up, 8 billion, to 80 billion in less than two terms. And then we elect him for a third term. So
that's amazing. Can I just say something quick there, Vinny? Isn't it funny, guys, that we're from three different countries? I'm here in Canada, Vinny, you're there in New Zealand, and Randy, you're in the States, and all of our elected officials currently have done exactly what he has described, where, you know, in Canada, they'd say the same thing with the Harper government, running the debt up, to an unimaginable degree. Obama, same thing. You know, made George Bush look like a schoolboy. But we all know the real effect here, and that's because these guys are just puppets. And this is a symptom of what's been taking place in the Ponzi scheme that we call the economic system. And now, so that's really where the juicy stuff is, and that's where people need to start looking, because if we get too embroiled in the politics, and I do agree with the way that Vinny's doing, I mean, in a way it can be a great opportunity to spread awareness about the issues when you sort of engage in the political arena a little bit. But at the end of the day, we have to look at the true underlying root causal factors as to why all of our countries simultaneously are being hurled into debt and being hurled into, you know, centralization under the World Bank and the IMF, and all of us are partaking in the same wars, and there's no real say. We know that, so we got to really get into the deep, you know, causal factors, I think, as to what really starts all this stuff going on.
What we've defined here is how our voting systems are similar. Now I'm going to describe how New Zealand's voting system is a little bit different. We've got a thing called MMP rather than first past the post. And MMP means that if you are part of a political party and you get at least 5% of the vote, that means you get to be represented in Parliament. Or if you get elected in a single region, you can get represented in Parliament too, regardless of whether or not your party makes the 5% threshold. Now, what's happened is people have, of course, just through the general rigmarole of the media and whatnot, all of the parties that actually stand for truth, justice, transparency, kicking out the bankers, exposing scumbaggery and whatnot, just because they don't get any media attention more or less whatsoever, it becomes increasingly difficult for them to make that 5% threshold, and almost as difficult in order to get any particular electorate seat. So it seems to be relatively controlled. However, there are people who, for example, the person I voted for, Winston Peters, who I've known and followed for a number of years. Back in the early 90s, he started up a investigation, and that was dubbed the Wine Box Inquiry, because he brought in to Parliament all his papers of this investigation in an old wine box, hence the Wine Box Inquiry. Now, what he was investigating was massive tax evasion by members of the New Zealand elite in concert with foreign banking interests. And he was demonized in the media ad infinitum. He was thrown out of his party. And then he came back with his own party and actually garnered nearly a 10% voting threshold. And I believe this is probably because he's been a politician for about 50 years. Now, just like every other politician, you can't trust 100% of what they say or do. However, you can look at their track record and be able to make at least a comparably accurate prediction as to what they will do if given power and what they have done when they haven't been in power. Now, I was in a meeting with him, I think this might have been about 4 years ago, maybe just prior to the 2008 election here, and he mentioned the Rothschild family in a speech. He mentioned the banks ripping New Zealanders off. He mentioned commission management systems for privatization, which allows for private management to take control of public assets without selling the public assets and without giving any dividends to any private contractors unless they actually make a profit with those public assets, right? And he said that this is the way that the Rothschilds actually control their wealth. And I found that this to be really quite incredible, because nobody I had ever heard in any political sphere in an elected party has been able to make those connections or at the very least say it. Now, he wasn't saying it in public. The second element is basically he's probably the least boring politician that I've ever heard of. He's very, very entertaining. And directly after I voted for him in the 2008 election, he was the first to be thrown out of Parliament because he called the earthquake recovery minister, Jerry Brownlee, an illiterate woodshop teacher on the House. And I vote only for troublemakers, specifically because they are troublemakers. And any spanner in the works that is in Parliament is absolutely worth supporting. And I have investigated this politician. I have asked all the knowledgeable people within the activist sphere that I have been a part of for many years in New Zealand. Can any of them show me anything or any evidence that Winston Peters has lied before, knowingly misrepresented his policies, or engaged in any other form of scumbaggery? None of them could come up with a single thing. Now, if somebody's been in politics for 50 years and they've never misrepresented their policies or lied to the public, that seems like a safe choice to me, even in a rigged voting system. And that's why I chose to vote for him.
Yeah, my God, that's incredible. I mean, and I guess the question that I keep coming to is, are we so focused on this bottom-down process where we focus the President of the United States, the Prime Minister, in other words, the top echelons of government, rather than drilling down into the local level and beginning to infiltrate up? Do you guys have thoughts on grassroots politics that maybe could make a difference?
I think that's a good question, Randy. And I mean, like, you've got to look at the integrity of the people, and you will more times, you know, you'll find people in the local municipal governments to be usually easier to work with and more receptive. And, you know, they're more like your average person, but it depends on the district, depends on the city, and you see corruption everywhere, but there are good people trying to do what they can. My parents in Saskatchewan, they've got some good connections with the local politicians there, and they really support these guys, and they've kind of vetted them and feel that they have integrity. And so it's good that people rally behind good politicians like that that are trying. But the problem is, and even they mentioned this, is that because it's so top heavy, because there is all these restrictions from the federal level of government, it really ties their hands on any kind of big issues. And even they are aware of the limitations they have, and they are trying to petition and try to get people to vote against some of these actions and some of these new laws and the new powers that are being given to federal governments. So I think that it's a better approach to try to see if we can get real people in there that have integrity on the local level. And it's just a matter of how drastic are they willing to go? Are they willing to go against the script? Are they willing to go against the sort of party line that they're given? Because we all know that it's a pyramid structure. Some of them are. And perhaps Vinny has, you know, he's right on about the guy he's talking about there. And in Canada, we do have some people that I'm aware of that are really trying to do active or become active and really bring about change. But how do you really implement it? How do you fight that's the size, the monstrosity of this big federal org now? Like, it's,
well,
I don't
can
know,
I
it's
can
a question of our time.
Can I interject here? Because politics happen once every couple of years, right? And one thing that really frustrates me is people who think that democracy is a weekend retreat, that they can just, you know, tick a piece of paper and then they've saved the country. No. 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 Here's what you got to do. Every single day, just like, what's her name? The big sis, you know, the see something, say something campaign. I'm going to be the big Vinny. The see scumbaggery, expose scumbaggery campaign. Every day, you've got to be exposing just a little bit of scumbaggery, you know. And, I mean, you get up in the morning and you get in your diary. Okay, I got to go to work on my slave job. I got to fill up the car. I got to feed the kids. And we'll add a little bit of exposure of scumbaggery on there as well. Cool. Now, if you spend the 1,000 days between elections where you elect a new scumbag exposing said scumbaggery, are you doing the wrong thing? Does voting in a corrupt system automatically void and make irrelevant all the corruption watchdogging, all the blogging, and all of the public discourse that you're trying to get out there, all the people that you've helped in the middle of the 1,000 days where you have no power of the vote, in which case the vote doesn't really have a whole lot of power anyway. It is what you do between elections that actually truly matters, and what you do during the election is kind of like a misnomer to a degree. And this is why I don't actually really, I came to the realization, I don't mind if people don't vote, and I don't mind if people do vote. What I mind is people who do nothing between voting to save their country from scumbaggery. That I do not accept as a valid life passage, and I don't like being associated with people like that, because it has occurred to me that they have abdicated their personal responsibility and they're more than willing for scumbaggery to control the country while they sit by and do nothing about it.
So basically, this is going back to that famous quote that's attributed to Jefferson, which says that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
I would say, you know, it actually goes closer to Jefferson's quote, that saying, my nation is the world and my religion is to do good. Or that might have been a Franklin or Andrew Jackson quote, actually. It doesn't matter who your figurehead is. You need to be doing the right thing. Not because you get rewarded for it, and not because people hold you in high esteem because of it, but because it's the right thing to do, and it needs no further justification than that.
But isn't this really the old bread and circuses thing? I mean, we started off tonight talking about the adulteration of social media. And I think the reason why social media has become so controllable and predictable is because they also, like everything else they do, have sugarcoated it. They've made it fun. People love their Twitter. They love their Facebook. Google gives me free email. Look at all the services we have. And so they allured us into this technosphere where we willingly put all of our goods right up on the table for them to watch, to them to spy on, them to co-op. And politics is the same way. We're comfortable. We're anesthetized. I mean, we're not. But I look at people right now and I keep thinking, you know, the economy is sinking rapidly, especially here in the United States. I've never, ever experienced, and I hate the word, but I'll use it anyway, the malaise that you see in the economic sector. And yet it seems like people were drilling in harder in their escapism, in their willful complicity with the system's deterioration, because they're almost now drugged by everything around them, by money, by sex, by sports, by whatever is their own particular vice. And so it becomes the question, how do you get down to the point where you get a critical threshold of interest in holding the leaders accountable?
Can I answer that? Because
absolutely.
I believe that the public isn't informed enough to be able to vote accurately and actually produce a government that represents their interests. Because do you know what the majority of women who voted for our current Prime Minister, who's a former Federal Reserve banker, you know why they voted for him? Because they thought he was sexy. All right.
That's what swept Bill Clinton into office in the United States.
Now, Kiwi women have a drinking problem. No more beersies for you, girls. All right. Something's got to be done about the alcohol culture in this country. It's just unbelievable. But what I've found is that this is all because of the media's fault. You know, basically, the media's job is supposed to be as the fourth estate, isn't it? To inform people so that they can actually make decisions based upon accurate information. And if the media does, in New Zealand, like they do everywhere else, merely report what a politician has said and not investigate whether or not they've said something that's true, that has evidence behind it, and report it anyway, there is nothing to stop the filter feeding of disinformation getting into the minds of people on a subliminal level to make them not only A, not give a frack who wins or not, and become completely apathetic with the entire situation, which is what the ruling and dominant parties want anyway, but two, even if they were to choose to vote, they wouldn't know who to vote for or why, because nobody knows any of the policies. You see Vox Popular people going around saying, why are you voting for this person? Can you name a single one of their policies? Everybody's like, so you're voting for somebody and you want them to have control over your life and your country, ostensibly, and you don't have a freaking clue who they are or what they're planning to do with your country.
Well, that's because you're usually asking them, you know, most people discuss what your favorite TV show is, what your favorite actor is, what your favorite movie is, who's your favorite politician. It's all in the same bag of stuff, cluttered information that's up there for most people, unfortunately. And you made a good statement that people are not correctly educated about the people that they're voting for, and they're not educated about how the system really works. And we all know this, that in general, human beings are afraid of change. And the question is, are we so afraid of change that we're afraid to act or, you know, bring about positive action that would change the system for the positive? I mean, we can only go up from here. I don't really think we can sink lower. I mean, we could, but no, I think that
trust mainly, scumbaggery has no upper threshold.
I agree. But guys, you know what I'm saying? Like, we at this point, whether it's the political sector, or the social sector, or any sector of society that you want to look at, we need to start asking the question as to, do we really want to be free? What does it really mean to be human? I mean, that's really the questions of the time with this whole merging of technology coming out now. Our humanity is in question. What does it mean to be a living, breathing human? How connected to the planet that we are a part of and that is our home and is the place that we reside and we have space and we have all the resources that we really need? You know, are we going to connect with that or are we going to divorce from that and create our own little party and keep going down this whole industrial road that's leading to a totally different type of human being altogether? Humanity 2.0, as they call it.
Right? So that's the next conversation.
Yeah.
I want to take a break here for a few minutes.
And we got to get this around to the people we're talking to and evolve it past politics, I think, and start saying, let's talk about just your humanity. What does it mean to be human? Can we have that conversation or are we still just wrapped up in talking about whatever the latest Hollywood buzz is, you know?
Can I say something for 10 seconds just before we go to break? It's about people abdicating their personal responsibility. Take me as an example. I realize that there is no Alex Jones in New Zealand trying to inform people about the scumbaggery that besets the country, regardless of whatever your opinions are on him. I simply saw the problem that nobody was helping the Kiwi activists get the word out to inform the public so that they can make informed choices. So I took personal frickin' responsibility for making sure that it happened, because nobody else will. If you have the idea, ladies and gentlemen, don't go to somebody and say, oh, I've got this great idea, can you help me with this because you're so much better at it and blah 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 blah. No, don't ask for help. That's your first big mistake. Start helping. That is your first victory.